Support for NPR podcasts comes from HBO, presenting the new dramatic series In Treatment, Monday through Friday at 9:30 p.m.
The Metropolitan Museum of Art sells more tickets than any other tourist attraction in New York City, more than the Empire State Building, the Statue of Liberty, or Radio City Music Hall. Last year, more than 4.5 million people visited the Met. So there was a lot of attention when the museum recently announced the retirement this year of the man who's been at its helm for the last 3 decades, Philippe de Montebello. A spate of news reports described him as the last of a breed, a patrician curator in an era when museums are becoming defined more by their boards and their economic concerns than by their art and scholarship. NPR's Margot Adler reports.
Walking into the Met on a Sunday late afternoon as the setting winter sun shines through the great doors, illuminating huge vases of golden forsythia, forsythia in January, hearing voices in a score of languages, people of all ages and nationalities, you know something going on here works. And out on the museum steps, locals like John Colapinto and Ellen Nathanson and tourists like Barry Cromarty feel it.
It's all just so well done.
I'm always learning. It's an amazing adventure.
It's one of those things you can share. You can be an old guy like me and you can be a 9-year-old like him. Everybody's happy.
To pull that off, almost everyone in the museum world says this is a time when a museum director has to be a scholar, a businessman, a politician, a fundraiser, and more. And Philippe de Montebello managed to do it all well. And although he doubled the Met size during his tenure, at the news conference announcing his retirement, he stressed other principles.
I would say the first is the primacy of art.
He said many other institutions have put something else first, what's called the museum experience.
When I was a curator in the European Paintings Department, people on the outside would say to me, I'm going to the museum to look at paintings. Now people come and I'm going to the museum. And one isn't quite sure what it means. I'm going to the museum because the cafeteria is good, to the shop.
When de Montebello started out as a curator at the Met in 1963, restaurants and shops were amenities, not draws. He isn't saying these things aren't valuable. They're just not primary. And when he started, there was far less public scrutiny of museums. This past year, the Met signed an agreement with Italy to return a number of artifacts the Italian government says were looted, including a vase that was one of the museum's most prized possessions, the Euphronius crater from the 6th century B.C. Ford Bell, the president of the American Association of Museums, says many museums and their directors are facing new stresses, demographic shifts,
changes in audience expectations, the role of technology in everyday life, people living very fast-paced lives and expecting to have sort of customized experiences. Museum directors today have to certainly be good at, you know, the business side of the operation. They have to be able to interact with government. And I think there's concern about museums that sit on large blocks of property. We're going to see government entities looking at some of these museums to pay property taxes.
Those are the very things that Philippe de Montebello says changed his job over 30 years, forcing him to deal more with legal, administrative, and bureaucratic issues. And because budgets for museums are often tight and government funding often in question, many museums are emphasizing what they believe will draw the crowds and bring in funds. The flashy new building project, another Impressionist exhibition. Jed Pearl is the art critic for the New Republic.
I think the museum world is more and more guided by a corporate model, a corporate way of thinking, an idea that you have to grow in order to survive. If you don't get bigger every year, if your collection doesn't get bigger, if your endowment doesn't get bigger, if your building doesn't get bigger, if you don't have more people through the door, you are failing.
When Pearl looks at the Met, which he views as having done most things right, he uses the word authority, a word de Montebello also used in his news conference. Pearl believes we live in a time when business models have enormous authority, but the idea of cultural authority is weak. And he says the few people who do have it, like de Montebello at the Met or James Levine at the Metropolitan Opera,
these are people who can say to a board of directors, this may cost a little more, but in the end, this is what's really important. And for some reason, we now have a situation where boards of directors, money people, are running things when they should be listening to people who really understand what culture is and how it's supposed to act in a the larger society.
Whether or not they are listening, what they are doing is building. A 2006 survey by the American Association of Museums found that half of the institutions that responded had begun or recently completed an expansion. Ford Bell says that's understandable. Museums need storage space, and it's much harder to compete for collections today, so museums have to attract collectors.
And in order to collect collectors, they have to have the space to show that art, because nobody's going to give their beloved collection to a museum to have it sit in the basement.
What's already in the basement is often the justification for building a new space. But Timothy Potts, the new director of the Fitzwilliam Museum in Cambridge, England, says the museum building boom is driven by a myth.
That museums are hoarding in their basements these thousands of masterpieces that no one ever gets to see.
And it's a myth?
Yes. It's a myth that they're all masterpieces.
Still, it's a lot easier to raise money for a building to house whatever than to raise funds for maintenance or for lights or guards. Many collections are not well maintained and are in bad shape, according to the American Association of Museums' Ford Bell. But for many art museums, the question is not art versus growth, it's how to get people in the door. At bottom, it's the same problem book publishers and media companies are facing.
I have a 14-year-old son. How do we dynamite him away from the computer? How do we get him into a museum?
And it's not something school trips are going to solve. Field trips are way down in the U.S. because of budget cuts and because, with No Child Left Behind and its emphasis on math and reading, there isn't enough time. Ford Bell will tell you that there are 17,000 museums in the U.S. They include everything from small house museums and battlefields to public gardens and zoos. And he thinks most have simply not done a good job articulating their core value to communities, that they are as important as schools and libraries. The Fitzwilliam Museum's Timothy Pott says institutions have to find a balance. Growth and numbers have to be kept in perspective.
Against the core mission of the institution, which is to collect, is to present, is to educate it in less spectacular ways than, you know, the much hyped exhibitions.
But the thing to remember, says critic Jed Pearl, is that the 4.5 million people who came to the Met last year came because of a longing for something unique.
And I think more and more in our technological age, with all the wonders of technology, people are curious about this different thing, this painting that is only there in that room.
Of course, it may also be available online, but the magic of seeing that unique thing in that room, rather than on a little screen in your office or bedroom, is what museums have to figure out how to promote. Margot Adler, NPR News, New York.
If you want to see a concert this weekend, you could head to the movies. Two 3D concert films will be in theaters. One puts you into a concert so popular that the demand for tickets inspired a lawsuit. The other puts you on stage with U2. Nate DeMeo reports.
Producer John Modell says his big three-dimensional international rock and roll spectacle, U2 3D, was originally inspired by that most American spectacle, the pro football game. His father owned an NFL franchise, and he'd seen things up close that you just can't get at home on TV.
When a play would come running down the sideline, 22 300-pound guys, it sounds like a herd of elk, and the ground is shaking. I thought, geez, if we could bring the average fan right down there, the power of that is just so awesome.
U2 3D stitches together several shows from the band's most recent tour into one feature-length concert. Modell's company, 3ality Digital, is using new technology to simulate the live experience. Except for a gee-whiz close-up where Bono reaches toward the camera, the 3D in U2 3D isn't about bringing things out into the audience. It's about bringing the audience in.
You are there, and you are the fifth member of U2, and you're the kid in Sao Paulo, Brazil, has never seen U2 before in their life and is being lifted off their feet for the very first time. And it was a spiritual, intense experience for them.
Thousands of American tweens had their own quasi-spiritual experience in the past year in places like Providence's Dunkin' Donut Center and Salt Lake City's Energy Solutions Arena.
It was amazing.
Lindsay Tabb was one of the lucky kids who landed tickets to the Hannah Montana Miley Cyrus Best of Both Worlds tour. It was a real-life concert performance by both Miley Cyrus, the teen star of the Disney Channel show Hannah Montana, and by Cyrus in the role of Hannah Montana. It sounds totally confusing, but trust Lindsay Tabb, it was totally, totally cool.
I've seen her concerts like on TV, and just being there was a whole nother story. I was like so close and I could see her like in person.
All 69 shows in the tour sold out, typically within minutes. Parents had a lot of explaining to do if they weren't quick enough on the dial or wealthy enough to afford tickets at the kind of prices scalpers usually reserve for Super Bowls. Now, Disney is giving those parents another chance to make good with their disappointed preteens with a concert movie.
What is exciting about 3D, especially for a genre like this, is that you feel like you are actually there. You feel like you can be, you know, in the front row of the audience.
Bruce Hendricks directed the film. He says when you combine 3D images with digital surround sound, and in this particular case, a movie theater filled with giddy preteen girls, it's transporting. 10-year-old critic Lindsay Taub agrees. She saw a sneak preview, and she says her friends who didn't get to see the show live now have the movie.
They'll definitely be able to feel like they were at the concert.
But they may still get shut out. Disney has decided to take the whole simulating the concert experience thing a step further. The film will only be open for a week, and panicked parents are now desperately trying to score a ticket to the movie theater. John Modell, the producer of the U2 film, says he wishes he could have seen his own rock and roll idols in 3D.
I think, wow, would have been neat to see Jimi Hendrix burn his guitar at Monterey Pop like this, as if you were standing right in front of him. You could almost feel the flames coming off the guitar. That would have been neat for my generation to be able to see that.
But he predicts that people in, say, Lindsay Taub's generation will be able to be right there, if only virtually, with Miley Cyrus, if she decides to burn her own guitar. For NPR News, I'm Nate DeMeo.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris. With Barack Obama's candidacy, some Americans, and more than a few journalists, have posed the question, is America ready for a black president? Voters are about to answer that question, but Hollywood weighed in long ago.
At some point over the next 10 months, all of us will entertain our worst fears and concerns. But I can also promise you this, we will prevail.
Mr. President!
Today's going to be the second most important day of my life.
And what would the first one be?
Well, I think you know. It's when I hit the game-winning three against DePaul, the Final Four.
You just lost my vote.
And we got nurses that work in hospitals that they can't even afford to get sick in. It ain't right. It ain't right. It ain't right. It isn't right.
That was actor Morgan Freeman in the Doomsday film Deep Impact, Dennis Haysbert in the popular television show 24, which served up not one but two black commanders-in-chief, and Chris Rock in the comedy Head of State. Of course, Hollywood has produced all kinds of presidents we've yet to see in real life. Women, Latinos, handsome single dads who date beautiful brainy lobbyists. But we wanted to test the question about a black man in the Oval Office. After voters have seen several black presidents on screen, are they more likely to elect one in real life? We put this to Todd Boyd, professor of critical studies at the USC School of Cinematic Arts.
I'm a bit hesitant to say that because James Earl Jones or Morgan Freeman, you know, or Dennis Haysbert played a president in a television show or in a movie that, you know, it means Barack Obama can be president. I think that's a bit of a stretch.
When it comes to presidential portrayals, does it make a difference if we're talking about portrayals in film or on television? On television in particular, in the case of 24, for instance, where David Palmer and later his brother Wayne Palmer were portrayed in that series as black presidents, beamed into people's homes every week for a period of time.
When you talk about, you know, a popular television program, it's not, you know, simply the representation on 24, but it's that representation in a larger context where we've seen African Americans do things in the last 10, 15 years that we've not seen before. For people watching a program like 24, perhaps this representation, you know, may have unconsciously made some things in society seem less troubling than they would have been had this representation not been there in the first place.
Let's look back, if we could, and reach way back to that 1972 film, The Man, where James Earl Jones actually portrayed the president. This is released during a time where America was sort of roiled by the Vietnam War. It was the height of the Black Power movement. The women's movement was also in full boil. How did Hollywood present this film when it was released, and how was it received by the public?
I think if you look at popular culture in the early 70s, particularly around black representations in Hollywood and on television, you saw a number of things presented as possibilities that no one really considered to be very timely. It was all about, you know, what could happen in the future. You look at that film, The Man, and it was a film representing a black president. But at the time, you know, you had a lot of groundbreaking imagery taking place, a lot of radical imagery in some cases. You know, this is the era of, you know, Deep Throat and Superfly and The Exorcist. And so looking back on it, The Man didn't necessarily represent any radical representation on the part of Hollywood, because you saw representations that were out of the ordinary on a fairly consistent basis because it was, you know, very much part of that moment.
Dad, just for the sake of argument, let's flip that idea around and say, if there is a black man elected as president of the U.S. in 2008 or some at some point in the distant future, instead of looking at how culture might have led to that, how would that event then impact American culture?
Well, you know, the most visible image of America at that point, particularly to the rest of the world, is going to be the president. And if that president is an African-American, what this means is that you're going to see this person's face on television, on the internet, on the front page of national and international newspapers every day. So it's symbolism, and symbolism is, you know, very important, but it's not the be-all and end-all. There are things beyond symbolism. At some point, symbols have to be grounded in reality, and that's when we really start to see and understand the impact of something like this and how it might, in turn, affect, you know, people's perception of American culture.
Todd Boyd, thanks for talking to us. Good to talk to you.
Thank you.
Todd Boyd is a professor of critical studies at the USC School of Cinematic Arts.
The ABC drama series Lost returns to TV tonight after 8 months, picking up where last May's unexpected cliffhanger left off. The castaways on that mysterious island now have rescuers on the way who may not be rescuers at all. Meanwhile, Lost itself may be network TV's biggest hope of rescue from the current writer's strike. TV critic David Bianculli has a review.
Last year, with its third season finale and a surprise announcement a few months later, the producers of ABC's Lost made some bold new moves. The final episode of 2007 ended with a surprise revelation. The subplot involving Matthew Fox's Jack, seen going through some tough times back in Los Angeles, was not an off-the-island flashback, an established part of each episode till then, but a flash forward. That meant that Jack and Kate, also seen in this flash forward, survived and got off the island. It meant that the writers could go in a whole new direction. Now the future, as well as the past and present, was open to them. And on top of that bombshell, the creators of Lost soon added another. They announced a schedule for the remainder of the series. 3 seasons of 16 episodes, 48 episodes in all, that would run without interruption each year and would, by the end, wrap up the story of the Oceanic Airline passengers. So far, so great. With an end in sight, the writers could pace themselves and serve as storylines and characters the way very few drama series, especially ones so full of questions and mysteries, get to do. But then came the writer's strike. Now, as Lost returns this week, it's planning to present only 8 of the originally scheduled 16 episodes this season. Whether those other 8 shows will be added to the remainder of the run, or will be, in a word, lost, has yet to be determined. But if we look at Lost the TV series, in the same way it's now telling stories, looking at the future as well as the present and past, we can predict that this series and tonight's episode are pivotal when it comes to the history of network television. The Writers Guild of America strike is close to entering its 4th month. Today also is the start of the February ratings sweeps, a month-long period in which the ratings a program delivers are used to set advertising rates for the following fiscal quarter. There are some big-ticket special events in the February sweeps, the Super Bowl, the Oscars, the Grammys, even the continuation of American Idol. But when it comes to scripted drama, nothing comes close to Lost. Lost right now is the poster child for broadcast network TV shows written by real writers, directed by real directors, and acted by talented actors. During the strike, it's almost like a remote island of its own, surrounded by swampy sludge like American Gladiators, Moment of Truth, and NBC's newest, tackiest unscripted competition series, My Dad is Better Than Your Dad. In a contest called My Network is Better Than Your Network, NBC wouldn't even qualify. So the future of network TV, in no small way, is tied up with the success of tonight's Lost. ABC has built it, but will we come? If we want more shows like this on the broadcast networks of tomorrow, we almost have to. Luckily, the opener itself is fabulous. For viewers, it's been 8 months since the last events on Lost took place, but on the show itself, it's been mere seconds. Jack has used a communications device from someone who parachuted onto the island to summon help, which is on the way. That communication was made possible because Charlie and Desmond invaded an underwater platform and turned off an island-wide jamming device. And as the show opens, Desmond returns in a canoe with a frantic message he wants to get to Jack about the would-be rescuers. Other familiar characters, Saeed, Sawyer, Bernard, Juliet, help Desmond beach his canoe and pepper him with questions. But only Hurley, who runs to the canoe while they're all talking, asks the most important question of all, about his best friend Charlie, who died in last season's cliffhanger. No one but Desmond knows that yet, but they're about to find out.
We need to get to Jack. We can't let him get in touch with our boat.
It's easy, Scotty. Everything's cool. Boat's on the way.
What? On the way? No.
Hey, it was Charlie.
No, that woman, Naomi, she lied. The people on the boat aren't who they say they are.
What?
Who are they?
I don't know, but we need to get in touch with Jack now!
Wait. It's all right, we can call him. We have a walkie, it's okay.
Where is it? Get it!
What do you mean if people aren't who they say?
Where's Charlie?!
I'm sorry, brother.
I've seen the first two episodes of the new season. Sadly, that's 25% of the expected total. And they do everything you'd want Lost to do. They service old characters and, yes, introduce new ones. They shed light on some old mysteries and, yes, throw out some tantalizing new ones. We learn how many other castaways got off the island with Jack and Kate, but we don't yet know how or, except for the identity of one other, which ones. And as for whether the rescuers are what they seem, put it this way. Has anything on Lost ever been what it seemed?
David Bianculli writes about television for TVWorthWatching.com.